welcome to Colored Red, a podcast that's all about Colorado true crime. I'm Laura, and I know everything's really tough right now. Everyone keeps saying be productive, and I'm not immune from what's going on right now. It's been incredibly difficult for somehow to focus on hobbies and stories, and I just feel like I want to stare at the wall, and it's just this weird purgatory right now. But let's try to take our minds off of that today with a case that takes us deep into the world of perverted creeps. This is the murder of Christina Tornay, but you might remember this in the news as the murder of Tina Sandoval. Today's information comes from numerous articles and the Weld County District Attorney page, as well as a book called Tina's Shadow by Sharon R. Dunn. There is also a Dateline episode called The Devil Was Watching, and I recommend really watching that episode because there's a lot of footage that I cannot find stills of online that you can go see of the wedding that I'm going to talk about and of a bunch of various things that I won't be able to find images for, so go check that out. This is the case that took a long time to solve, and it really only got full closure in 2017. This crime was years in the making, however, and one incident really solidified this path that the murderer was on, and that occurred in 1983 in the form of a note. This was a note that a woman named Jennifer, who later on I'll refer to as Jenny when I talk about this murderer's history, and she came home to a note on her dining room table written in blue ink that said, "I'm going to kill you." And it was just sitting on her dining room table. And the difference with this note and any other than what it said on it, was that it was wedged in there underneath an 8-inch butcher knife. Ginny was the high school girlfriend of John Sandoval, the creep of our story. And in 1983, she had just gotten back into town after breaking up with John and leaving the state for an entire year. When she was his girlfriend, she had to deal with a number of things like fights and paranoia and insane jealousy. John was really in the habit of constantly accusing anyone he dated of cheating on him. So since getting back into town, Ginny realized that John was being her shadow. He wanted Ginny back, and she didn't realize at that time what lengths he was really prepared to go to for that to happen or for her to not be with anybody ever again. So after she found the note, she took this chance and entered her apartment again a couple of nights later, only to have John come up behind her and place the butcher knife underneath her throat and ask, "Who is he?" John then told her that they were going to go for a ride in the country. And John had done this song and dance with her before, and she knew that no matter what she said, whether that was the truth or lies, none of that would really be convincing to him. And it wasn't what he wanted to hear, and no one knew what he wanted to hear because it didn't really matter what she said. If she said that she didn't have a boyfriend, that wouldn't matter. If she said that she did have a boyfriend, that wouldn't matter. So as John pushed her out to her car, she fought back and she actually got away. She survived an incident that likely would have seen her facing the same fate as John's later wife and the murder victim of my episode today, Tina Tornay. And as it would happen, Jennifer would also provide investigators with valuable information about John when they were investigating the disappearance of Tina. Namely, that he was a genuine paranoid psychopath. He was usually disorganized. He thought people were following him constantly. That he had this tendency to fly into a jealous rage, and that she thought that he was definitely capable of killing Tina, and that in her heart, she knew that he had. The day before Tina Tornay Sandoval disappeared on October 18, 1995, she was working a shift as an oncology nurse at the Colorado Medical Center in Greeley. She had reached out to coworkers during that night about her increasing anxiety about meeting with her ex-husband, John Sandoval, so that he could give her some money to cover an IRS debt that the two had incurred when they were married. Tina telling her coworkers about these issues was really uncharacteristic of her. She was usually a rock. She was an extremely successful nurse who came to be that by being a really successful and smart student. She wanted to go to medical school one day and become a doctor. But Tina had been sharing more and more with coworkers and friends lately. She wanted everyone to know that if something happened to her, it was John who did it. And this information came as a shock to most people who knew Tina, because she and John had done an excellent job of hiding John and hiding who he really was behind the scenes. In her case, she did so because she was scared of him. There had never been a domestic violence charge against John from Tina, and there had never been any 911 calls. To everyone else in their life, John was an extremely devoted and caring husband, and almost to a fault, he hung Tina on his arm like a prize. So, like I said, it was a shock to everyone when Tina filed for divorce just a couple months earlier in August in 1995, after a knock from her door from the police. The police told Tina that John had been involved in yet another incident of stalking a woman, a story that she had become really accustomed to hearing from police knocking on her door. And she told them what she usually did, that she didn't know where he was or what he was doing. And this was really the last straw for her. Tina was done. She told friends that John was a panty sniffer, that the month prior to her filing for divorce, she found multiple garbage bags filled with women's underwear in their garage. And over the years, police coming to knock on her door had become so normal, and she had uncovered a lot more about this double life that her husband had been living. John Sandoval was so unhinged and so jealous that when Tina told him that she wanted a divorce, he started banging his head against the wall, and he actually put a gun to his head and threatened suicide if she left him. So when Tina left her shift on the oncology ward on October 19th, 1995, she was obviously very apprehensive about meeting with John, and her coworkers and family were apprehensive as well. Her sister Susan told her to call her as soon as the meeting was done, and Tina assured her that she would call her. So Tina left work and went home to change and then drove to John's home that he was sharing with his aunt, who lived in the basement with her two small children. And she was never heard from again. That call to Susan, her sister, never came. And immediately, Susan knew that something was wrong. Susan called their mother, Mary Ellen Tournay, and they went to John's house first to see if Tina's car was there, and it wasn't. So they then drove over to Tina's apartment and discovered that she wasn't there either. So they drove back to John's, where his aunt answered the door. She told them that she hadn't seen Tina and that John wasn't there. And the aunt was normally really jovial, but this time she was cold and she was distant. And her mother and sister reeled, sitting in their car, wondering what to do next. Mary Ellen went back up to the house again, and the aunt then allowed them into the house, where Mary Ellen found her daughter's jacket hanging on a chair. And the aunt had this really grim thing to say, according to Mary Ellen. She said, "I think you should put out an all-points bulletin." And Tina's mom went right to the police station and reported her daughter missing. Usually when we hear these stories and an adult goes missing, people are told to wait a little while because an adult has the right to go missing. But in this case, the cops immediately knew that they had to act. They did that because they heard that her husband was John Sandoval. The police were already incredibly familiar with John. He was already well known to them because of the numerous number of calls and complaints about him in the past. They considered him to be one of the more unhinged and dangerous men in the city of Greeley. So upon hearing that Tina was missing, the police immediately went over to her apartment and they found her work clothes and her work badge, and everything looked like she had just changed out of her work clothing and left. What they didn't find was her car, and they didn't find it until 3 a.m. the next day, parked in an obscure parking lot just yards away from the townhome that John had been arrested at for trespassing only weeks prior. The police now had some really tough decisions to make. John was sitting in his house, and they knew that he had something to do with this. Lieutenant Brad Goldschmidt started looking into John's past to try to dig up anything that they could to arrest him for, because they were really sure that John was involved, and they wanted to get him before he ran. So Goldschmidt found out that he was arrested for trespassing and that he was mistakenly charged with a misdemeanor when he should have been charged with a felony. So he rewrote a new arrest warrant in an effort to get him into custody while they searched for more evidence. And the prior trespassing charge that happened only weeks before was from a woman who had left a party and walked a friend home, only to return to her house that was blocks from John's home to find a pair of shoes sitting outside her sliding glass door. She entered the home to find John hiding out in her closet. She actually sort of knew John, and he immediately said that he was there looking for her roommate, but she knew that John knew that the roommate had moved out weeks prior. And luckily, John left the scene without incident, but the woman did file a trespassing charge against him. And this is just the first of many stories I will be telling you guys about the antics of John Sandoval. So the police in 1995 had this new warrant, and they showed back up to his house that he shared with his aunt. And his aunt answered and said that John was in the shower, so they waited and came back to basically fulfill this order. And this time the aunt said that she was mistaken, and John actually wasn't there. And they knew that she was lying. And the officer made this really tough decision to go into the home without a warrant because they felt that John was washing away any evidence that he had on him in the shower at that time. And when they were in there, John tried to escape out of a back window of the house, wearing only his jeans and a t-shirt on a cold October morning. And he tried to flee barefooted through basically snow-frosted grass in the yard. And he was apprehended by an officer and taken to the station. Unfortunately for the detectives, John was incredibly seasoned in dealing with police officers. And he didn't say anything except that he wanted a lawyer. And he began doing something else that was really, really odd and would be brought up many more times when discussing his potential guilt. He began frantically chewing his nails. And there are videos of him that are probably in that Dateline episode of him just absolutely going to town on his nails with his mouth, because presumably he didn't want the police to collect any evidence that might have been under his nails, and he knew that they would want to. So at one point, they even cuffed one of his hands to a bar on the wall in the room, but that didn't stop him from maneuvering himself to continue to chew his nails. And you might ask why they didn't go in there before to collect evidence from under his nails, and the reason why they didn't do this is because they didn't have that warrant yet, and the detectives were outside frantically trying to piece together something for the DA to use, other than this trespassing charge, to make a case they needed to collect evidence from underneath of his nails. And they didn't want to really mess this up and collect evidence that couldn't be used later on. And so basically they were trying to do this game of trying to keep his hands out of his mouth without doing something that was actually illegal to him. So another thing John did in custody was not stop moving so that they could take a picture. And police had to basically come in and hold him down so that they could get a shot. And he claimed that the police had injured him when apprehending him. And he had cuts and stuff all over his chest and back that they knew that they did not do. And so they took him to get x-rayed. And even in the x-ray booth, he dropped really creepy comments to the female x-ray tech, like, "Have you ever done something that you wish you hadn't?" And John was this master manipulator. And all this was evidence of that fact. He knew that the police would hear those comments, and he liked it that way, and he wanted to drop little tidbits and little sort of nuanced phrases like this to frustrate them. Meanwhile, while John was in custody, they searched his car that was in his driveway and found some really interesting items, including a bucket, a white plastic trash bag, a round pointed shovel, a level, a small red flashlight that was attached to a rope, a small coil of rope, and a Taurus 9mm semi-automatic pistol with 5 rounds in it found in the center console. Co-workers Johns at a call center said that he hadn't been to work the entire week before Tina's disappearance. A scent dog also tracked a scent of whoever drove Tina's car last, and it tracked right back to John's house. And the dog also later identified John as being the person who produced that scent. The scent dog also traced Tina's scent north of Greeley into some undeveloped grassland areas, but the dog soon got tired and they abandoned that search. And police collected everything they could in John's house as well, including his wet, muddy clothes that were in his bathroom that he presumably took off when he was showering the morning that he was arrested. He also had water-stained glasses that were sitting on the counter that he apparently didn't try to flee with, and he had muddy boots and 2 of Tina's credit cards in his possession, which wouldn't really be considered important until much, much later on. Police revisited the area that the canine unit tagged upon earlier, and they skimmed the nearby Boyd Reservoir with divers, and they even called in the help of NecroSearch, which is a group of scientist volunteers that I've talked about before in other cases. And they typically come together and use geology and ecology and various other scientific points of interest to pinpoint an area that a body might be located. And unfortunately, all they came up with was nothing. Now the focus turned less to finding Tina, who they strongly felt was no longer alive, and more to proving that John had something to do with it. So with all of this, detectives were working really hard to try to understand John and Tina's relationship. Tina was gone, and in their hearts, they knew that he had something to do with this. So let's have a look at John and Tina's relationship. Tina introduced John to her parents just 2 weeks before their planned marriage, which was planned for January 1st, 1992. For the most part, her parents liked John. He was amiable, he was kind, he appeared to dote on Tina, and this is really true of most psychopaths. They know how to turn on and off certain emotions and do so with a certain level of sincerity. But prior to the wedding, Tina, as well as the Tournay family, began receiving really disturbing phone calls. The caller ended up being a woman who said that she was John's first wife, Renee Delgado, and she had a dire warning for Tina and her entire family, that John was a psychopath and that Tina shouldn't marry him. Unfortunately, Tina and her family chalked it up to just be a jealous and bitter ex-wife. So Tina and John did end up marrying on January 1st in a small chapel in Drake, Colorado. And John's family wasn't really out of the picture either. They were involved. John brought Tina over to his own family's house for get-togethers, and his entire family said that they absolutely loved her, and they thought that he was grounded by her. And they would have her over for Broncos game parties and picnics, and she got on well with everybody in his family. But things weren't perfect forever, and in 1993, Mary Ellen Tournay, Tina's mother, received a tearful call from Tina saying that John had been arrested for violating parole. She said John had been on parole from supposedly stealing from a lady in California, and that he was arrested on allegations that he was stalking a woman in downtown Greeley. This was the first that Tina or her family had ever heard of anything, and John said that the theft was during a rough time in his life and that he needed food and he needed money for various bills, and they believed him and they forgave him for that excuse. And he said that the stalking was false and a huge misunderstanding, and they believed him when he said that as well. John spent a short amount of time in jail for this, and everyone, including Tina and Tina's family and John's family, all visited him in jail, and they felt sorry for him. believing that it was all a misunderstanding and that he was innocent. So let's get into the week before Tina went missing. Again, John wasn't in work for that entire week. A hairdresser that John went to said that he seemed really depressed, and he told her that he had been sitting in his room for days in the dark, trying to process their breakup and upcoming divorce. He also told the hairdresser that he thought Tina was seeing another man. And a friend who drank with John at a bar that week said that the two commiserated about women problems, and John actually said, "Too bad we can't just kill them." And his friend thought that that was a really weird thing to say. With this information, with nothing else and nobody, the case went cold. On November 17th, 1995, John was sentenced to 9 months in jail for that trespassing charge, and he was also charged with felony gun possession due to the firearm in his car, because he couldn't have a gun as part of his parole agreement, and a judge actually sentenced him to 6 years total for all of these charges. He would end up spending only 4 years in jail, and then he would move to Las Vegas to live with his dad in 1999, where he spent the first year wearing an ankle monitor. But Tina's family didn't stop searching. They organized searches with volunteers all over the area, holding on to this glimmer of hope that she was still alive, and they peppered the states with missing person flyers. They contacted psychics, and the Tournais were really into psychics during this time. They told them that they saw broken light bulbs and a camper and a certain window looking out of a barn. And the Tournais followed up on this information to a T, and they went down rabbit holes trying to locate old barns and campers all over Greeley. Eventually, these people called dowsers came out of the woodwork to try to help the Tournais family. Dowsers are people who claim to have a skill in divination or a psychic ability to find things, usually water or buried metal, gemstones, oil, and grave sites. They usually use sticks and other crap as dowsing rods, and to no one's surprise, the dowsers didn't find Tina either. Anonymous tips poured into the police department, and most of them led absolutely nowhere. So on November 1st, 1995, a tip was received that John had worked digging grave sites at Somerset Memorial Gardens in 1993, and they discovered at the cemetery there were three open graves the night that Tina disappeared. Police checked the area and the vaults, and they didn't find a body. And they had no other reason to dig up the grave sites and no ability to get a warrant to do so. So this became another dead end for them. In April of 1996, they took to the air and they searched on foot all over the areas where the dogs hit the scent and beyond, and they found nothing either. That year, the Tournais family hit upon another psychic tip. Old mines in the mountains. They spent the summer trying to seek out mines from Greeley to Wyoming, and they would hike up to these mines and they would stare deep into many a watery abyss of black sludge and deep down into holes, and they found nothing from these ventures. One jail inmate told police that he overheard John telling someone else that if you want to get rid of a body, you have to feed it to the pigs. So police followed up with farms in the area and found nothing. On July 31st, 1996, another inmate said that John told him he cut up his wife and that police would never find her. The mother of another inmate said her son told her John had shot Tina and buried her body near Red Feather Lakes. But this woman refused to give her name to the police, fearing that John would be released from jail and come find anyone who snitched on him and kill them. Tips like this continued, and they came in for months and months. All of them led absolutely nowhere. And these weren't just tips about where Tina might be buried. There were also tips that Tina was still alive and that there were sightings of her. On October 10th, 1996, a Florida trucker claimed to see a woman who looked a lot like Tina working in a restaurant, and a local Florida officer took a picture of Tina to the restaurant and came back to say that the waitress at the restaurant did look a lot like Tina, but that it wasn't her. And the Tournais continued to seek even more help from psychics, and here's one bit of a transcript from a psychic talking to the Tournais family about Tina. Okay, I can just tell you what I get. And then you're going to have to take it from there. I don't know how else to explain it to you. Okay, it seems like, why did I do that? Well, I need more information than that, don't I? It's almost as if a green automobile was involved in this. The man that was involved in this had darker color hair, a little bit taller than she was, about 185 in weight. His eyes are dark. In fact, it almost looks like there are two men involved in this. I can't make out the other guy. I don't think he's the one who did the deed. He was paid to haul the body. The woman's dead. Did you know that? So that's the kind of stuff they were getting from psychics, and the months pressed on. Goldschmidt was in the habit of taking shovels and digging himself at sites that people said looked oddly depressed in the ground or different than areas that were surrounding it. On September 28, 1998, police drained a lake at the southeast corner of Weld County, Road 51 and Colorado 392, based on a tip from an inmate named Thomas Loveland, who had more credibility than other inmates because he actually bunked with John for a long time. And the police were impressed by the specific map-like details he said John had given him about where Tina's body was. A polygraph of this inmate even showed that he wasn't presenting with any deception at all. The draining of the lake provided no body, and it's possible that John did actually tell Loveland the story that Loveland shared, and he believed all of it, which is why the polygraph didn't show any deception, because John was the one who told the lie. This inmate, like several people in this case, went on to play with the detectives about correspondence with John in some effort to remain relevant and get a plea deal. And none of it really panned out. And random searches with dogs and necrosearch continued well into the early 2000s. One false lead came from a guy named Zachary Patton in February of 2005, who made up a story in some kind of bizarre attempt to impress friends at a party, though I'm not sure what kind of praise he was really expecting out of this story. The story he told would eventually, by a coincidence, turn out to be closer to the truth than anything, which you'll find out just how close it is to the truth at the end of this entire podcast episode. His sister worked at Sunset Memorial Gardens Cemetery and Mortuary during the time that Tina went missing. He told friends that John enlisted him to help put Tina underneath a coffin in a gravesite at that cemetery. Police interviewed his sister, who knew absolutely nothing about it, and said that her brother had a knack for making up stories. Police interviewed Zach, and he spilled the beans that he made up a story while doing meth at a party, and that he didn't know Tina or John. At the time, for those reasons, the story was filed away as nothing more than that, a story. And it was a story, but as I said, they would know just how close they got to Tina simply by coincidence at the very end. In May of 2005, Mike Tornay, Tina's father, came to the police with stories about how his friend who had been having dreams of Tina had a disturbing sort of story to tell about Tina in these dreams. And here's a little bit of the transcript of those dreams. She said she and John had been arguing over a love letter she had received from another man. Tina was in the back bedroom of the house. She turned around and John picked up a black object from the table, either a flashlight or a candlestick, and he hit her on the head several times. Another man came into the room and asked John what he was doing. John replied, "Shut the fuck up and get out of here." A man left, and John returned to beating Tina about the head. Others were in the house, and I witnessed the beating, but didn't try to help Tina. John and the three friends sat in a circle, trying to decide what to do with the body, and decided to bury her in the house where no one would find her. Tina told me that they took out some concrete and placed her in it, and then poured concrete back over her. She said there would be mold on the wall near where she was buried. These kinds of ridiculous psychic visions and tips continued well into 2007, and then in 2009, the entire case got a refresher. Detective Keith Olson took over the case that he had been going back to for some time. Now, with Ken Buck as the new district attorney for Weld County, he decided it was time to have a fresh look and try to dig up something that was missed before to really nail John Sandoval, who at that time was living in Las Vegas. As Keith Olson looked over this mountain of documents, he noticed the credit cards that were in John's possession when they arrested him at his house back in 1995. The credit cards had been documented, but not a ton of thought had ever been put into the fact that they were Tina's credit cards. The fact that they were Tina's cards wasn't even documented. Tina had used those cards only 3 days before she went missing, and she had told others, and John had told them, that she hadn't had contact with John Sandoval for an entire month leading up to their meeting. As you might recall, John refused to actually talk to the police in his first interview, instead deciding to frantically chew his nails and demand a lawyer. So he had no explanation, and didn't even try to provide one, for how the cards came to be in his possession when Tina had used them only 3 days prior. Another thing he saw was that John's shirt was drenched with sweat. There was sand and dirt in the pocket and in the hood of this hoodie that he had taken off to have a shower. So how does sand and dirt get into the hood of a sweatshirt? Like by throwing a shovel of dirt over your shoulder? His glasses that were on the bathroom counter were stained with muddy water droplets. And one more thing in his car, a flashlight attached to a rope. So just for a minute, everyone, imagine being down in a hole that you're digging. How would you light it in the middle of the night? With a flashlight tied to a rope? Maybe around your neck or hanging from the outside, right? From the beginning, John was the only person they could find who had motive to kill Tina. So the prosecution realized that they had 3 hurdles to overcome here. They needed to get an arrest warrant without a body. They needed to get through a preliminary hearing without a body. And get a jury to be convinced of his guilt without a body. Olson also considered how John acted the night that he was arrested after showering. He jumped out of the window to avoid being caught. He furiously tried to destroy evidence under his nails, and he never even asked what he was being arrested for. He just refused to talk. No one who was innocent would do all of that. So on June 10th, 2009, they actually got a judge to sign off on an arrest warrant. And on June 18th, police and Weld County detectives surrounded the home of John Sandoval in Las Vegas. They ambushed him as he was on his way to the car, and Olson described that John's face went stark white, as if all the blood had drained from it. This time, he came quietly, and he cooperated for photos, but still said the same old John Sandoval line that he wanted a lawyer. And for some odd reason, without even asking, he knew exactly what he was being arrested for. He knew that he was there for the murder of Tina Sandoval, which was an odd conclusion for him to come to, considering that he had been telling friends for years about running into Tina on trips back to Colorado, and that she was alive. No one else, other than John Sandoval, not her friends, not her family that she loved, had heard from Tina since 1995 on October 19th. So police then started to piece together the criminal past of John leading up to the disappearance of Tina, and what they found was that, in his heart and soul, John was a night crawler. In fact, I would compare John's breadth of crimes to those of the Golden State Killer. He just didn't get the media attention that those did. There are also components of John's crimes that remind me a lot of Ted Bundy. So let's get into the secret criminal history of John Sandoval, which is largely unknown to the Tournay family, and it's not even known in its entirety to really anyone else that he knew. John was a guy who grew up with very few consequences for his actions. His mother, Mary Lou Sandoval, grew up with 13 brothers and sisters herself, and she eventually became a hoarder, and they often had to carve a path through the mess in the house as kids. His mother's family was constantly at each other's throats about money. They were greedy and hateful towards each other, and the entire family life really centered around money. His dad was named Efrain Sandoval, and he was smart and educated and had gotten a scholarship to go to college to become a lawyer, but it just never panned out. And he slipped into a biker sort of lifestyle and later on claimed to be a private investigator in Las Vegas. John's parents ended up divorcing when he was 7, and he began a childhood of attention-seeking and brat-like behavior. And, for instance, he once unplugged the fridge at his mom's house and let all of the food inside spoil before his family knew about it. He and his brothers would set up booby traps for their friends, and the traps would actually hurt neighborhood kids. In 1982, John reached this turning point when he began hanging out with an actual criminal named Michael, and he was really taught the ropes of burglary and some small drug dealings. John's hobbies didn't just involve burglary, he also started window peeping, and once asked his brother if he would come with him to check out women taking showers at the University of Northern Colorado dorm. And his brother declined, and he told his brother that he would often sneak into girls' college houses and basically rape them and touch them when they passed out after parties. And he would get into bed with them quite often and just start fondling them. John's first girlfriend was named Jenny Myers, who we have heard from before at the very beginning of this podcast. And she moved in with him, his cousin Jesse, and some other guys. And his cousin basically recalls that they were always fighting or having sex, and John never wanted her alone in the house because of intense jealousy and the belief that she would just start sleeping with his roommates or his cousin. Eventually, Jenny left him and went to Wyoming, and John stalked her all the way up there until that fateful event when he stuck a note into her dining room table with a butcher knife. In Greeley, John worked at a Taco Bell and spent his free time calling women he worked with, including managers, and telling them that he was going to kill them. In 1983, John was identified as a suspicious person in the Joslyn's parking lot at the Greeley Mall, and a month later, he was found in a Holiday Inn parking lot in a steamy car with his pants pulled down. A woman who saw John following her in his car started making erratic movements to get away from him and then pulled into a local bank and darted inside, only to be followed by John inside. John started off as a burglar and trespasser, and eventually in his high school days, he became a burden to local police, and he was always the first suspect in a string of similar cases in Greeley, Colorado. When police came knocking, his family would always back him up. They'd say that they didn't know where John was or what he was doing, and they got used to lying for him and his antics. In one example, a woman awoke to a man standing over her bed with a knife, saying, "Be quiet, I got a knife and I'll cut you." The man then fled after the woman screamed, and she could never fully identify John so that he could be charged for that crime, so he got away with it, and police fully believe that it was John who did this. John knew his way around a crime, and he knew how to skirt being caught. He was a loner, he went out at night, and he prowled the streets of Greeley completely by his lonesome. John was actually a suspect in the 1984 disappearance of Janelle Matthews, whose body was found only recently but whose case has not been solved. By 1985, he was jerking off openly in his car to women who walked by local businesses. Whenever John was caught, he would feign intoxication or he would accuse police of being racist towards him. In 1986, John was the chief suspect in a burglary where he tried to play a hero. A woman reported that John came to her house with her house keys, claiming that he had chased a burglar from her home. The house was the home of a woman that he worked with at the liquor store, and 2 days later, he showed up again to this house with a gift for one of the women in the house, a necklace, saying that he felt bad for her and wanted to cheer her up. On April 10th, 1987, John was 22 years old and on his first day as a trash collector. On this day, a woman running along a jogging trail said a man leapt from the bushes and dragged her down and shoved his fingers up her shorts and into her vagina. He then ran off and sped away in a garbage truck, and the district attorney declined to prosecute this case. In the late 1980s, John dated another woman who then broke up with him shortly after, and he snuck into her parents' house and killed their dog. John was in the habit of telling stories to his friends about being in someone's house, only to have police come, and he would run and climb a tree really quickly outside, always evading the police. And around this time, he also lit a man's shed on fire, and he was getting into numerous bar fights all the time. In 1988, John claimed to be the victim of burglary himself at a liquor store that he was working at. They found him tied up in a pool of blood from a cut, and they immediately assumed that he had an accomplice and that he had basically planned the entire burglary himself. He kept giving inconsistent stories about what happened, and the only way to access the cash register without damaging it was knowing which button to push. And John was the only suspect in that robbery ever, and they never found anybody else. When John was 24 years old in 1989, he left to go to California for work after committing several burglaries in Greeley that he would never be charged for. In May of 1989, he was arrested for burglarizing the house of a woman he met while working at security at a jewelry store. He had approached her under the guise of getting help registering his car in California. And he even invited himself over to her house so that she could help him figure out this registration. She knew his car, and one day she came home to see a glimpse of it speeding away from her house, which had been completely ransacked. All of the goods stolen from her home were then located in John's van. In 1991, after being released, John was found peeping in Greeley again, and he was cited for third-degree trespass, and his parole was extended to 1993. John registered as a student at Ames Community College in Greeley, and this is where he met Tina after noticing her at the gym one day. And he, of course, married Tina on New Year's Day, 1992. A year later, a woman who worked for the Greeley Tribune saw a car following her, and despite her attempt to make turns and switchbacks to get away from it, she made it all the way to the Greeley Tribune with it still following her. And she parked in the parking lot and dashed inside, only to be followed inside by John Sandoval, who claimed that he needed to place an ad to sell a piano. And the woman had gotten his license plate, and he received a harassment charge for this. John had been attempting group therapy, but didn't really commit at all to it, and his wife Tina often wondered where he would go for hours on end most nights. In 1994, he was arrested for stalking two women in Douglas County when they saw a green Geo Prism following them. They went into the mall to shop, and then when they exited, a Hispanic man approached them and asked them if they were having car trouble, and they went to their car to discover that the tires had been slashed. And the Hispanic man approached them again, and they ran back inside the mall. In July of 1994, a State Farm agent reported a man stalking her all over town and making her life completely miserable. Despite reporting him multiple times, he was eventually charged and pleaded no contest to misdemeanor harassment and received a suspended sentence until March of 1995. But he continued harassing people all through the summer of 1995, leading to his wife Tina leaving him. At this point, John believed that he suffered from a disease that he couldn't help, and Tina had had enough, at least until she disappeared a couple of months later. John's acquaintances and exes all had a really similar memory of him, that he felt entitled to whatever he wanted, and he would lie, cheat, and steal his way to get it. In 2009, Detective Olson was dumbfounded by everything John had gotten away with to that point, with pretty much only minor slaps on the wrist. The ball was dropped so many times in the case of John Sandoval. So naturally, when John was arrested for the second time, detectives were incredibly curious exactly what he had been up to in the city of Las Vegas since he had been released from prison before. Olson set about figuring this out in a number of ways. He contacted John's co-workers at a Sam's Club in Vegas that he worked at. He talked with John's cellmate while he was awaiting extradition to Colorado to see what he spilled. He talked to neighbors and friends, and he went through John's possessions. One of John's closest friends in Las Vegas had absolutely no idea what John had been up to or what his history was. John played on a local softball team. He showed up to children's birthday parties, holidays, and he was a really great friend to some people. But behind the scenes, he was a different person entirely. His close friend told police that John had mentioned Tina before, and that he would often go visit her in Colorado. He said that John had provocative photos of a blonde woman hanging up in his bedroom that was later determined to be Tina. Detective Olson went about the task of going through all of John's photos, as well as his extensive video collection. In the photos were pictures of Tina, but nothing that looked like it was taken past the year of 1995 when she disappeared. He even had an entire album of their wedding photos. The videos were by far the most disturbing items in John's collection. He was quite the videographer, and he took all the videos himself. John had edited them all into careful mosaics of women he had stalked and assaulted so that he could view them over and over and relive those moments. So Detective Olson went through these videos, and one of the first victims he saw on the videos was a woman named Janelle Gross. She appeared on one of John's many walks down the Vegas Strip and all over the downtown area that he often took. John found her crying outside of the Venetian Hotel, and he asked her if she was okay in this video. With a paternal sort of confidence, he offered to help her, and she informed him that she thought she had lost her credit cards, and she was completely drunk. He convinced her to get into his car so they could go back to her hotel, and as she sat in his car on her phone, John continued filming, and she didn't seem to really notice him filming, and the film would show him reaching across the car and feeling up her skirt and between her legs, an incident that she had tried to push into the back of her mind, as she stated when she was later interviewed by police. When they arrived at the hotel, he parked in the back, which she thought was really odd, and strangely enough, she actually got away from this incident without anything further happening. But John had gotten her cell phone number, and he spent the next days completely blowing up her phone incessantly about wanting to see her again. The rest of the tapes showed incredibly similar incidents, some 3,000 stalkings and sexual assaults and rapes, and for those of us who have ever spent time in Vegas, this is about to get incredibly disturbing. John was an upskirt pervert, and police couldn't really find out how he concealed this camera when he was out, because it was oftentimes appearing to be in his hand, and he didn't really even try to conceal it at all. But what he would normally do to walk around was carry the camera pointing out of a leather bag or a satchel with a piece of tape over the red filming light. In 2005, he was caught filming women going into a gym. He often posed as a shopper in stores, and he would find a woman he liked and ask her to get something down from a high area on the shelf and would film her going up a step stool. His favorite activity at night in Vegas was following around drunken women, either alone or even in groups, as they left clubs and casinos and pretending to offer them assistance. Sometimes he wouldn't offer anything. He would just quietly follow at a distance to see where they went. One such incident, he is seen in the video following a clearly very drunk woman in the elevator to her hotel room. She enters the room, and the door doesn't close all the way behind her. John then waits in the hotel somewhere else, and then later on enters the hotel room, which was left ajar, to find several girls all sleeping passed out in beds in the dark. The camera has this night vision on, and it shows him approaching a bed to see the face of a sleeping woman in the bed, and pulling back the covers, pulling down her underwear, fondling her, and even penetrating her, all without her waking up. Then he masturbates next to her and leaves. And guys, he has hundreds of such incidents sneaking somehow into rooms of drunk girls partying in Vegas to fondle and rape them while they were passed out, mostly occurring between 2002 and 2009. Vegas was truly his perfect playground. He also paid women to have sex with him consensually, but most of the sex workers were a little bit more skilled in detecting cameras and filming, and he had far fewer videos of these incidents. Other sex workers either allowed it to happen or didn't realize, and he was seen forcing them to put on stockings and high heels that he would keep on his person. He also had girlfriends. Earlier on in 2002, he met a woman named Erin Muir, and he paid her for months to essentially act like his girlfriend, and she traveled with him to Colorado for vacations, and she spent some holidays with him. She even saw pictures of Tina in his home, and John told her that Tina had run away with her drug dealer. Erin started thinking about the relationship and thinking that it was actually getting serious until he began slipping away every night for hours on end and texting other women incessantly. During this time, he really turned lying into an art form. He quoted the Bible frequently. He talked about his skills at karate and chi. He bragged about money despite making less than $20,000 a year as a clerk at Sam's Club. He wanted people to think that he was a jet setter going on amazing vacations. He would often vacation to Colorado and make entire videos by himself, acting as if he was there with friends and talking to people off camera who weren't there. He would be basically pretending to have the time of his life all by himself on beach vacations. He often told co-workers about his made-up past, that he was a fireman, that he had been a foreman of migrant workers, a contractor who built condos, and he even told people that he had been a private investigator, like his dad also pretended to be. His co-workers rarely believed him, and most women thought that he was a bit of a blowhard, and they instinctively completely hated him. His family had largely disowned him, except for his mother, and in all honesty, his only true friend in the world, the only thing that knew who he really was his camera that he talked to all the time. And the lies and stories didn't stop, even during his questioning in 2009. John tried to claim that the mud and water and sweat on the clothing from his home back in 1995 was because he had been digging to repair a sewer line in his mother's backyard. His mother even made a point to organize this story with him when they were talking to each other in jail, and she corroborated it. Detectives naturally wondered why John hadn't mentioned this supposed ironclad alibi in 1995, and he had no answer for that. As it so happens, the sewer pipes supplying the street to John's mother's home had been repaired, but not until the early 2000s, and any repair on them would have shut off the sewer for the entire block, alerting a plumber who lived right next door and was the only person to ever do repairs on the line for two decades. So this so-called alibi was a complete lie. During the questioning of a family acquaintance, a man named Dave Harvey told detectives that John had asked him for tranquilizers the night before Tina's disappearance, and that it now crossed his mind that he might have actually drugged Tina that night. Other friends of Tina had deeper revelations about their marriage, that they always suspected that John was physically abusive, and that he had once slammed Tina against a wall and choked her during an argument. And this was a fact that her parents and family had no idea about. An old professor of Tina's admitted that they had discussed her problems, and Tina told the professor that she had an exit plan in case things went south. And the exit plan at no point involved Tina disappearing completely. Even with all this under their belt, all of the circumstantial evidence, there was really not much physical evidence linking John to really any crime. Prosecution wasn't entirely sure that they had a good case against him. After all, for the past 14 years, John had been claiming to friends and family that Tina was alive and well, and that he saw her often. But he couldn't produce her now. And oddly enough, he dropped those stories and acted like he had never said it as soon as he was arrested. His antics continued all the way through the preliminary hearing for this trial, and he threatened to fire his defense attorneys constantly. He even tried to pursue an angle that the cops had beaten him up when he was arrested in 1995 and that he was trying to seek justice for that. In the preliminary hearing, there was a certain level of doubt about what was being presented, but ultimately they decided that the case should, in fact, go to trial. By now, John's parents had returned to his side. His mother continued the belief that everything John said was the truth, and that everything said against him was a lie. His father sold off his cars, a Jaguar, his motorcycles, all for money to hire a high-powered attorney for John. His mother visited him frequently in jail, often talking with him very cryptically, as if in code, letting him know what was going on with the plans for his defense. And so when I say that they talked in a sort of code, I'm not even kidding, they would often be on one train of thought, like, hey, how's it going? Such and such happened. Oh, I know you've forgotten, but there's some critical alibis that I know of. Yes, anyway, your brother has this issue going on, yada, yada, yada. These are kind of not the exact words, but this is how they talked. It would be like they were having a conversation and then blurt out a fact about something and then continue on with the conversation as if nothing had happened. So, of course, all these conversations were being recorded, but they were so all over the place and cryptic that investigators could barely make heads or tails of them. They got progressively weirder as time went on. His mother would explain the creation of Israel and then jump immediately into the Lord causing the Gulf oil disaster. John would quote scripture that wasn't even in the Bible. And in between all of this, there were fragmented sentences about the upcoming trial and different things that his mother was trying to pull out of the closet to try to get a good defense going for him. It was just insane. At another point, his mom came in and said that she couldn't remember the name of the person who owned the kayak, and maybe it was moved or the name was changed. And then John told her he couldn't remember the name of the person. So think back, for my astute listeners. Now is the time to pause and consider what they might actually be talking about here, because it's not kayaks. But don't worry, you'll find out. There's one bright point in all of this. Because of his mother's frequent visits to the prison, they caught the attention of the other inmates, and John was jumped and beaten. So, nevertheless, John and his mom worked tirelessly to examine all the documents his defense attorney had and mull the evidence over, attempting to create ways to explain it away. And I won't bog you down with all the details about the court proceedings, but here are some interesting parts. Remember that aunt that he was living with? She was put on the stand as a witness, and she doubled down on the lies herself to protect John. She said that she saw John making breakfast for Tina the morning after Tina went missing, that she had a different recollection of Tina's mother coming to the house and seeking the jacket, and saying that she never lied about John not being there. She also claimed to not remember any further communication with the police, even going as far as to say that the house didn't have a working phone, despite the fact that a picture of the house after John's arrest could prove that a phone was present in the kitchen and that they could prove it was working. She still doubled down that the house didn't have a phone. They showed the aunt pictures of John the morning of his 1995 arrest, and he had scratches all over his body, and she looked genuinely shocked and said that in certain moments of passion, things happen. John's cousin Jesse, who had always been a little bit closer with Tina, actually carried on a small relationship with Tina after the announcement of the divorce, and he kind of went from shoulder to cry on to rebound, and even though this relationship was incredibly brief, defense attorneys tried to cast doubt on John's guilt by presenting the possibility of another jealous lover. They also did their best to poke holes in his stories between then and on the stand and make a case that he was being uncooperative with police. The prosecution made a big part of the trial dedicated to convincing the jury that Tina was actually dead, even though her body had never been found. Unfortunately, a month prior to the start of the trial, a murder mystery aired on primetime TV, showing the story of a woman who disappeared and then resurfaced many decades later, and prosecution really wanted the jury to believe that this wasn't the case for Tina. Here's a short list of the evidence that the prosecution brought up to convince the jury that Tina was dead for all intents and purposes. Lack of a phone call to her sister the day that she disappeared. No contact with any family member or friend since October 19, 1995. She left behind wallet and contents, cell phone, work ID, stethoscope, apparently all clothing, car, nursing license, checkbook, personal hygiene items, and her eyeglasses that she needed to see. No activity on any known account since before October 19th, 1995. She was on the dean's list for her studies and dedicated to them. By all indications, she loved her job, continued with all known medical appointments before then. Tina had just signed a new apartment lease. She never renewed or applied for a new nursing license. Statements to witnesses that she was excited about her new life. She paid bills up until the day and IRS debts off within days of October 19th, 1995. Still on October-November work schedule. If anything happens to me, John did it, she said to Susan and Jesse. No known sighting of Tina anywhere in the country. No use of her social security number since October 19th, 1995. Her parents eventually got an issuance of a death certificate and a payout on a life insurance policy for her body in the amount of $27,000. John had told friends and a cellmate that he had seen Tina and that she's now tattooed up and hanging out with bikers, and that Tina called 4 months after Sturgis trying to get back together. The list goes on, and all signs point to Tina is dead. Sandoval's defense attorneys kept bringing up the lack of forensic evidence. The clothing of John's had never been tested for gunshot residue, nor was there a complete DNA profile from anything that conclusively pointed to John. What they did have was fairly new forensic technique of using touch DNA, and they used it to show a partial DNA of John's on Tina's credit cards in his home. In addition to all of this, one solitary blonde hair that they could only say was similar to those of Tina was found in his car. DNA, or at least a sufficient amount of DNA, was not found on any of the other evidence items. There's a bit of bickering in the courtroom with the he said, she said, and long, long witness list. It was the longest witness list in the history of Weld County, and probably even longer than that of Chris Watts. Forensic scientists and investigators from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation took the stand, as did John's mother, who again tried to give her really confused, archaic sort of answers. And so the case went to the jury. Initially, 10 of the 12 jurors were convinced of his guilt, but eventually a verdict came down after 7 hours. The jury found John guilty of first-degree murder of Tina Sandoval. And John was silent. In fact, throughout the entire trial, he was sociopathically silent. It seemed that the only person he could ever talk to was his mother, and the only friend who he had now lost was his video camera. He was sentenced to life in prison, and he did attempt appeals for a few years that were denied, but his conviction was eventually overturned, and there was a retrial on March 17, 2016. During this time, investigators were able to approach this case again with the goal in mind now of retrieving Tina's remains. For a year, they went down many paths and nearly lost hope that they would ever find her until on March 22nd, 2017, 22 years after her murder, John Sandoval, in a plea deal, finally provided District Attorney Rourke and police information that led them to her body. Sandoval told them that on October 20th, 1995, in the early morning hours, he found an open grave site in Sunset Memorial Gardens Cemetery in Greeley, which was scheduled for burial that afternoon. He dug 2 feet below the open grave and buried Tina's body, which had been wrapped in several layers of industrial-quality plastic. Unbeknownst to the Sunset Memorial Gardens employees, the afternoon burial continued as planned, preserving Tina's body under the vault of the person buried in that plot. So think back to that kayak. What they were really talking about was gravestones. The DA and several investigators with the Greeley Police Department exhumed the gravesite and positively identified Tina's remains. For the exchange of this information, John Sandoval pled guilty as part of this plea bargain and was sentenced to just 25 more years starting in 2017, with the condition that he would serve 5 additional years of parole following his release. And he was eligible for parole during this time. Not to make 2020 any worse than it already is for anybody, but John Sandoval is actually up for parole this year, and he's eligible to apply for a halfway house every 6 months. Hopefully we will never see that absolute maniac on our streets ever again, but it's a possibility. So that's the murder of Tina Tornay Sandoval, but let's just call her Tina Tornay. And that's it for this episode. I'll have a historic episode for you guys next month, and until next time.